The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yes, indeed. Miriam McGillicuddy, lecturer in law at the MTU and solicitor in Tralee, with us on the line again, or in our studio again. Miriam, good morning to you and thanks for joining us on the programme.
Good morning, Jerry. Good morning, listeners.
We have a load of queries to get to, lots coming in today, lots that we're holding over from last month as well we didn't get a chance to get to. So we'll dive right in. A listener asks, is an executor of a will entitled to get the same amount in the will as the others? Now, I'd imagine this is all to do with what's actually in the will, Maria.
That's right. That's right. And the executor has a very onerous responsibility, like they have to manage the will, and they're very often in and out of the solicitor's office signing forms, maybe minding a house, paying utility bills, and making sure all the property, both physical property and money in bank accounts, is preserved for the benefit of the beneficiaries. So it's a very onerous task altogether, and I find people, you know, it's a huge responsibility, and people do find themselves under stress with it and that. And it's so important then to leave the executor something in the will for the trouble. Now, usually in a lot of wills, the executors would also be major beneficiaries, so they have a vested interest in ensuring the estate is managed correctly. But if they're not, if they're people maybe outside the family that people trust to, and maybe they feel that it would be better to have somebody from outside managing the situation, those people would need to get some benefit in the will. And I'm surprised sometimes when people appoint executors and don't leave them anything in the will. Yeah. But it is possible to happen. Yeah. And that leads on to the next query, of course, Jerry.
A legal question. How do I step down as executor of a will I no longer want to be involved with?
Yeah, and I mean, some people would then say that I don't want to be involved. It's going to be a lot of trouble and I'm getting nothing out of it. So therefore they can renounce, and they sign a simple renunciation.
What happens then? Who is the executor, or the person has passed away obviously, so what happens?
Well, usually, as I say, when we're doing wills, we say to people to appoint at least two executors.
Okay.
In case something happens, one of them, or one of them doesn't want to act. So if there's a remaining executor, they can work away. But if there's no remaining executor, it will go by way of law, usually the residuary legatee, who's ever left all the catch-all at the end of the will, you know, left what's left over, might be the person entitled to be executor. But otherwise it's set out in the Succession Act 1965. But it's quite awkward, because instead of doing a simple grant of probate, you have to go do a slightly more complicated grant of administration with will annexed. So it isn't an ideal situation. And that's why we very often say to people when they're doing wills, make sure your executors are willing to act. And often people ask them to make sure that they're willing to act. But as I say, you should, ideally, they should be left something substantial in the will. They can, of course, Jerry, apply for executor's expenses, you know, if they've had a lot of travel and subsistence and had to do a lot, they could claim for executor's expenses as well.
Yeah, okay. And look, from that then, can someone be appointed an executor without their knowledge? And all of a sudden they get a call one day and says, by the way, you're executor of so-and-so's will.
That very often happens. Like, people might appoint, you know, people in their community, auctioneers, the parish priest, without actually asking them. And though those people are entitled to decide whether they will act or not, depending, I suppose, on how friendly they are with the family and whether they feel, you know, the responsibility in relation to the situation. But otherwise, they could decide, no, that's not for me.
That's not for me.
And put it back to the family, basically, because usually it should be somebody from the will itself that would apply to then to be executor in the situation. As I say, it's set out in the Succession Act who would be entitled to be the executor. And one applies then through the probate office for the grant.
Always better to ask, I suppose, Maria.
Yeah, that's right.
Always better to
exactly,
ask.
Exactly, Jerry, you put it in one. And it is very responsible. And in a big estate, there's a huge amount involved. And people might be very often liaising with the solicitor's office for years in a big estate. So, you know, just to be aware of how responsible it is and to, I suppose, appreciate what the executors do and to make sure that they're compensated in the will.
Yeah, yeah, certainly is a thing. Okay, we've a couple of more to get to here, Miriam. Hi, Jerry. Can you ask Miriam about the right of ways? A private road owned by one of the owners of a number of houses that use it for access. It's poorly maintained. How can this be dealt with? How can we, the other residents, get the owner of the road to repair it?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because, I mean, they have the rights of way over it. And they, you know, the owner has the bother of people having the rights of way over it. And really, it's up to all the residents and the owner. And if the owner is not using it that much themselves, really, it's up to the people using the right of way to get together and put together a little pot to maintain the road at the end of the day. You see, this area is quite... you know, it's interesting because there's not a lot of legislation on it, and it's really dependent on people clubbing together and managing things themselves. And the person who sent in the query has raised a very interesting point, because there's nothing there. We have in the legislation something around party structures, so if there's some problem with a boundary, you can bring it to court and get a judge to decide. And but with these private rights away, we often the road might be let into disrepair and nobody would might do anything about it. So there could be scope for something in the legislation like this party structures, where you could apply to a judge who, and a judge would set out, look, this is the way it's going to go, this is what you have to do, and this is who's responsible to maintain it. But in general, it would be the people using the right of way.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly would be. Okay, that's that. We have a couple of more queries to get to. Speaking of executors, Miriam, they're all out this morning.
That is.
I'm an executor and currently doing probate. My mother put 25,000 in my credit union account 10 years ago. Do I have to declare that to revenue? Or rather, do you know if revenue look into people's accounts to see what cash gifts they got in previous decades? Could I, in other words, could I get away with not telling them?
Yeah,
says the listener. No, I can tell you right away, and it depends on how, you know, well planned out it is. But if you want to avoid cash, you're talking 10 years ago, you can give 3,000 a year tax free.
Exactly, that's right, 3,000 a year tax free. And remember, she's a daughter, so she's entitled to 335,000 from her mother tax free over her lifetime. So, I mean, in relation to declaration to revenue, I mean, there's no fear of in relation to a gift of 25,000 anyway. There wouldn't be any tax due on it from her mother. But it went. In relation to the revenue form, say it's the revenue form for her mother, she does have to declare previous gifts, and she has to, they ask a specific question: have you received any previous gifts from anyone? And
yes,
you unfortunately you have to fess
yeah,
up at that stage. And you see, if for example you got 500,000 from your mom, then that amalgamates with the previous gift and it brings you over the threshold, and then you pay tax at the 33%.
Okay, and that's what you do. But it depends. Is there any sort of, if and this is just me kind of being hypothetical here, if the 10 years ago, if that was a gift for their own use is one thing, but if the money was transferred for a specific purpose, like for funeral expenses, I'm transferring it to you, to your account, so that there's no delay when I pass away, that takes care of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, and Jerry, this can be done a lot, and then it's very hard to prove that that's not actually the person's money.
Yes.
But it's the mother's money. Now, if it was a joint account and it was solely used for the benefit of the mother, one could say that it's part of the mother's estate. So one has to be very careful of about those kind of trust accounts, because revenue are going to say it's in your name, that's that. And they might necessarily, you know, say that it was for funeral or other expenses. You see, I suppose it's better be upfront about things. If mom wants to keep money for the funeral, keep it in her own name. It then goes into the estate account, and the funeral expenses are deducted from the estate, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But the other one you're thinking of probably as well is the nomination.
Yes.
And often, a person will nominate in the credit union, and that goes completely to the nominee straight off. It still has to be declared in the revenue form, but very often then the person has is under a responsibility to use that money for funeral and other expenses, whereas in fact the rest of the next of kin might get off, you know what I mean, of having to pay it. So it's just to make it clear, so that everybody's clear about what the money is for, and ideally it should be kept, if it's for that person, it should be kept in their name.
Certainly should be, that's for sure.
For revenue purposes,
yeah, should indeed. Miriam, there's a very strong rumour, says a listener, that one of my neighbours has been questioned about allegations of child sex abuse numerous times. How can I find out if there are files on record about him? Lots of young children in the area. No one wants or needs that type of danger around them, says a concerned parent.
Yeah, I mean, people are entitled to the presumption of innocence. One is innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
And we have a sex offenders register once people are convicted, and they, you know, that's kind of not a public record. But I mean, if one has concerns, one could approach TUSLA or the Gardaí in connection with the matter for a quiet chat. But in relation to the overall thing, you know, vetting records, if the person was to apply for any job in relation to, you know, involving children, obviously that might, there might be some impact there. But other than that, as I say, I think approaching maybe TUSLA and the Gardaí if one has a concern around one's own children. And I suppose the bottom line is we just have to protect all our children all the time.
Yeah.
And you don't know when somebody might be around. I mean, we saw what happened to Madeleine McCann. So, you know, we just have to be careful with our children.
Thankfully,
and supervise them at all times.
As best you can. Yeah. Thankfully, these incidents are very rare.
But sorry.
You would have no right to go to the Garda. I want to see what investigations you've done about X, Y, and Z.
No. That's all GDPR, under GDPR. But you could have a quiet chat to, you know, if one has concerns in connection with, you know, that you can approach TUSLA and the Gardaí and just have a chat about it, and they may be able to allay your concern, concerned parents.
Okay. Miriam, I have a question about statute of limitations. Does a case just have to be initiated before the 2 years are up, or must have it gone through the court within the 2 years, asks Mary.
Yeah, that's for personal injury cases. There's a limit of 2 years from the date of when the injury happened, or the date of discovery of the injury, for example, asbestosis or something like that. And it's only from the date initiated. Mary is dead right there. It's only from, it's the time stops once you initiate the claim.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have brought it through the courts, because sometimes with court lists, as we know, and it's a big issue at the moment, it can take years.
Yeah.
So
a very long time.
So it only has to be initiated. And we have a very easy way of initiating personal injury cases now through the Injuries Board. So once one initiates the case through the Injuries Board, and they, with a medical report, they issue a letter, and time stops running from that letter. So that's very good for people now, in terms of an easy way of stopping time running. Just to remember, note as well, that there is other cases like trespass, nuisance, battery, assault. They have a much longer time period of 6 years.
Six years.
Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, with our squatter's title, that's the 12 years. You have to have initiated the proceedings by the end of 12 years. So just to note that there are different time limits in law as well.
Yeah, there are. So 6 years for those more serious cases, but it's statute limitations, 2 years for personal injuries.
Yeah.
And initiated.
But just, and again, I suppose that's the point I'm making as well, Jerry. Sometimes one might think one is out of time because there's a 2 year limit. But the 2 year limit doesn't apply to all cases, and it's important people get legal advice on it, because there may be another avenue under the 6 year rule, if you know what I mean.
Yes, yeah, and that's an important one. Okay, we're going to talk more. We've more queries to get to with the Legal Lowdown. We'll get to those after we take these. Miriam, a listener gets in touch and says, I'm in my early 60s. I'm single, no children. I live in the family home with my elderly father. Three siblings, we're all married with children living close by. In the event I'm left the family home while I live, so I can stay in the house, and then the house is left to a grandchild who owns the house while I'm still living, could you tell me who's responsible for the major upkeep, like roof repairs, etc., and these situations? So what we're talking about here is a right to life situation.
Well, it could be either of two things, Jerry. It could be a life interest, that they have the house for life and after their death it goes to the grandchild, or it could be a simple right of residence, and that right of residence could be exclusive or otherwise. So for example, the son could live in the home until they die exclusively with no one else, or they could have a right to reside with other people, if you know what I mean. So it could be quite varied that way. And then, I suppose, depending on which, ideally there should be some kind of an agreement between the parties, or set out in the provisions of the lifetime interest or right of residence as to who is in charge of what. For example, the person with the staying in the house would be responsible for utilities, obviously the local property tax, and for, you know, decoration and cosmetic maintenance, and that then the remainder person would be in charge of major structural repairs. I mean, it's always the problem is, like the rights of way that we mentioned earlier on, very often it isn't made clear who is responsible. And obviously for somebody who's a remainder interest in the house, if somebody's not going to mind it, at the end of the day, they're going to be left with maybe a wrecked dwelling at the end of it. So they have a vested interest in keeping an eye on it and keeping it, making sure the structure is kept right.
Yeah, and would it then be, like, if it's a grandchild that has it, that this is all being done in advance of the person who owns it passing away, so would there be a parent then be engaged to be, well, you're the kind of the trustee, I suppose, for the grandchild?
In a way, yeah, for looking after the house and that kind of thing and making sure that it's kept in order. But at the same, and obviously, there could, you know, if it went to litigation, the grandchild could be claiming that the person needs to mind it while they have it and not waste the asset, as you say, that there's a bit of a trust situation. But really, it's a type of situation where it should be clarified who's responsible for what. The grandchild as well will have a large tax bill there in relation to the house as well. So that would need to be taken into consideration. I mean, if she just left the house to the daughter or son for just straight off, that might be a better situation rather than leaving it to life interest. But again, they could look at the tax implications of that.
Yeah.
And they obviously want to leave it to one grandchild only.
Yes.
Rather than a few.
You would be complicating it if you put it to a few, and then who's responsible for
exactly.
this, that, and the other
that's
thing?
That's right, yeah.
Who pays
that's
what?
Right. But at the same time, the person who has the remainder interest always has to keep an eye on the house, and usually there should be some kind of agreement between the parties. I mean, if the person who's left the house is on a pension, they're obviously not going to be able to do roof and structural repairs. And if the grandchild is working, they'd be expected to, you know, do that. You know, so they need to come to some agreement, and it should be set out who's responsible for what.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Miriam, just a final point. I wanted to ask you as well, there's lots of advertising around this at the moment as the government looks to make people aware. The assisted decision-making legislation has come into force. This is a big change for people with disabilities.
It is. It's huge. And it's a big help now, because we've three different types of assistants who can come in and be available for people. You see, the problem we've always had is that people have autonomy, and their rights have to be respected, and in terms of GDPR, no one else can stand in for them. But where a person has a disability or is getting older and vulnerable, they might need somebody to act on their behalf and liaise with social welfare, the revenue, the bank. And this new assisted decision-making legislation is bringing in a three-tiered structure. So if you're kind of not that vulnerable, just little bit vulnerable and need a bit of help, you'll have an assisted decision maker who will come along and help you with the banks and all that kind of thing. Then your next tier up is a co-decision maker. So you couldn't make maybe major decisions like changing your bank account or selling your house without the co-decision maker being involved. And there are people you trust who will operate with you. And then the last one would be, for example, if I'd all out Alzheimer's and I couldn't, my really had completely lost my mental capacity,
yeah,
I'd have a care representative who'd come in and operate for me. But all those people have to take on board my wishes,
yeah,
and respect my, what they would think would be my wishes, what they know are my wishes, because ideally the people who are appointed will be people from our own family. But the decision is done according to a book of quantum. So there would be slight variations between it and the courts. But in general, once that's assessed, that's it. You have the choice of going to courts and appealing to a judge to get a higher amount. But if, for example, there's an offer made, or some offer has been made in relation to a personal injury case, a solicitor might say, look, this is a good offer. But at the end of the day, it's up to the client. And they can decide, look, I'll accept that or I'll go to court. You know, and the, obviously the client has autonomy in that regard.
I'm not happy with that. I want to go further.
And Jerry, it's very often like the way they assess personal injury cases is based on the medical reports. So, and the, I suppose for the listener's point of view as well, the personal injury awards have gone down. If a solicitor is advising, they're advising in the context of what the courts are giving out at this particular time for particular injuries. And there is, as I say, a book of quantum. It should be available on the Injuries Board website, which gives an idea of what each injury...
What's the ballpark
for each injury.
Yeah. How come a will can be contested when a person made their will in the full knowledge of what they were doing? Does that relate, Miriam, to somebody who feels that they weren't adequately provided for in the will?
Yeah, I mean, if a person is compos mentis at the time they did the will, and there's very little you can do to contest it unless you say that they were unduly influenced. You know, maybe they were vulnerable. They were full of sound mind, but they were vulnerable and they were put under pressure or some kind of coercion in relation to doing the will. You could challenge it from that point of view. It's quite a difficult case, you know, to try and prove that. But that's one avenue. Then if you have been cut out or given a reduced sum in the will, the only people who can contest are children or cohabitees. They're the only people who can apply to court for a fair share where they feel they've not been properly done by, provided for.
Okay. All right, Miriam. Brilliant stuff. Thanks so much for that this month. Again, that's Miriam McGillicuddy with the Legal Lowdown.